Megan, would you like to announce the lawyers?
May it please the court. Mr. Mark Kleiner, arguing for appellant, and Mr. Franklin Cram, arguing for athlete.
Mr. Snyder, proceed when you're ready.
If it please the court, I am Mark Snyder, and I'm representing the appellant in this matter, Lease Finance Group. This is an appeal from a judgment and garnishment and a denial of new trial as to that garnishment. Essentially, the facts are that in the underlying case, a void judgment was issued. My brief goes into some detail as to why that judgment was not good and void, but essentially, substituted service was had on the Secretary of State without compliance with any statute or identifying that statute. The sole pleading in that was that the defendant was a foreign corporation and could be served through the Secretary of State. Making the pleading defective on its face and the judgment void. The Texas Supreme Court in Whitley versus L&L Realty said that the pleadings must allege facts which, if true, would make the defendant subject to service under the statute. If we look at either of the two possible statutes, the long-arm statute or the Texas Business Organizations Code, there's no allegation as to the defendant's location, that the defendant, the transaction arose out of the defendant's business in Texas, or that the defendant was doing business in Texas. Under the Business Organizations Code, there was no allegation that the defendant, was required to maintain a registered agent in Texas and failed to do so, or that the defendant, appellants as plaintiff had attempted to serve a registered agent with reasonable diligence. The Supreme Court in Whitley versus Wiltley, as I said they must allege facts that, if withdrew, would make the defendant subject to service under the statute. There must be proof in the record that the defendant was served in accordance with the rule. We would also note that even the Secretary of State's return is certificate of mailing is defective, as it is directed to Lease Finance, not Lease Finance Group, LLC. This court has held that such deficiencies are fatal in the case of, and I apologize, I'm missing the case from my notes. Now, the defendant has attempted to argue that that it's enough that the plaintiff got notice and that compliance with the statute is not necessary when the defendant gets notice. The Supreme Court in Wilson versus Dunn dealt squarely with that issue. In Wilson versus Dunn, an order of substituted service through the defendant's apartment manager was signed, but it was not supported by the proper verification or affidavit. The defendant even admitted that the apartment manager had delivered the requisite service to him, and he failed to answer. The Supreme Court says that actual notice without proper service is not sufficient to convey jurisdiction to render a default judgment. Jurisdiction is dependent on citation issued and served in the manner provided by law.
But counsel, we're not really here on the default judgment, are we?
Well,
the default judgment could have been tried to be appealed or set aside or filed a bill of review or something. But this isn't that procedure, is it?
A bill of review is pending. However, in order to establish the right to the new trial or to set aside the garnishment, and I've probably taken this in incorrect order, one of the elements is we have to show that the underlying judgment was void. And that's the issue I'm dealing with, and I dealt with it out of order. I apologize, Your Honor. So I'll move on quickly to the motion for new trial. First of all, there's nothing in the trial court's record that shows that my client was served in compliance with the rules of garnishment. The only record before the court was a copy of a fax sent to me the day before the order in garnishment it was issued. At that time, I had not appeared in the case and therefore was not the proper person for service. Opposing counsel. In it, he said he had sent it to my client. But there was nothing in the court's record when the judgment was entered evidencing that. There is nothing in the court's record that indicates that the fax number was, in fact, my client's fax number. So that there is no record of service in compliance with the rules of garnishment.
But counsel, it seems like the burdens of proof are kind of backwards. I mean, the garnishment states that there was proper service, the judgment of garnishment. So I think it was your burden to introduce evidence that it wasn't properly served at the motion for new trial hearing, right?
No, Your Honor, because it is a default judgment. Therefore, there must be evidence in the record of service.
But I'm talking about the judgment of garnishment.
The judgment of garnishment was also a default judgment as to my client.
But the judgment of garnishment states that service was proper.
That is correct.
And so in light of that, we presume that recitals in a judgment are correct. So at the motion for new trial hearing, I'm thinking that it was your burden to come forward and show that proper service was not attained.
Not in a default situation, Your Honor.
Okay.
In a default situation, which this is, a garnishment's a new proceeding. There must be evidence in the record to show proper service on the defendant. We raised in the motion for new trial, admittedly not as clearly as I should have, primarily because we did not become aware of the judgment until shortly before the time for hearing, the deadline for filing a motion for new trial. Approximately 4 days, so it was a rush to get the motion for new trial. Essentially, though, we allege that we had not been served with a proper writ of garnishment and that it was defective. At that time, it became incumbent on the court to review its record to determine if, in fact, the writ is served on us was defective. When the court looked at its record, it would find no evidence of any service. So I believe that was sufficient to raise the issue. At that point, because there was no service in the record, under due process, Peralta, and even under Dunn versus Wilson, no service, we were entitled to have that judgment set aside. Even if there was good service, my client is entitled to have the judgment and garnishment set aside under a Craddock standard of a motion for new trial. First, that the failure to answer was not intentional, but was due to a mistake. The mistake is clearly set out in my affidavit that, one, I did not know when my client was served, that based upon the date the attorney had told me he had not served it, I erroneously calculated the date based upon service of a citation and not service under the garnishment statute. The case is cited in my brief.
I have a question. I'm just unfamiliar with any cases applying the Craddock standard to a judgment of garnishment. Have you found cases doing that?
Not specifically as to a judgment of garnishment. It is still a default judgment situation. We apply it to motions for new trial. We apply Craddock in variations to nearly any form of final judgment. I have not found any case that holds that it does not apply. I did not specifically look for that. I believe that there are cases where new trials have been held in garnishment, but I did not look for that in specific. I've briefly reviewed for you then the meaning of the second element of Craddock, which is that the underlying judgment was void. Defendant the appellants. We're doing a bill of review at the same time, so I have to be careful about what terms I'm using in regard to what case. It did cite two cases, including Graham versus Graham, where it said that if the court has jurisdiction over the subject matter, that is sufficient to prevent it from being a void but an only avoidable judgment. Graham and the other case cited, however, are both pre-Peralta cases. And in Wilson v. Dunn and in Platt versus Browning, the Supreme Court says a judgment is void if the court does not have jurisdiction over the defendant. And Dunn, Browning, and American Universals versus D&B clearly state where a defendant is not properly served, the judgment is void and subject to both collateral and direct attacks. Those are the facts in this case. We've clearly shown that, first, the record is devoid of any service of the garnishment on the defendant. Therefore, it should be set aside as a matter of law. The courts have said that failure to make service and in a garnishment case, an appearance does not waive defective service or lack of service. The courts have said that failure to service under a traditional service of citation is not waived by failure to raise it in a new trial. I believe that is equally applicable to a garnishment situation. Indeed, because of the imminent and immediate effect of the garnishment action, and it's important to due process and fairness that those rules regarding service apply. We've clearly shown that even if the court does not believe it was sufficiently raised in the motion for new trial, that the Craddock standard was fairly met. The defendant in its the appellant in its brief alleges that attempts to use a negligence standard in looking at the failure to answer. As I state in my brief, Ivy and Ferguson, the Supreme Court and Dallas Court of Appeals specifically reject the negligence standard, and it is merely conscious indifference, conscious indifference or intentional neglect. My affidavit to the motion for new trial clearly states and shows that the failure to answer was not due to either of those. Then, having shown the judgment void, at this point, we were entitled to a new trial under a Craddock standard. Based on that, the judgment of the garnishment should be reversed and remanded to the court, and we ask that the Court of Appeals do so.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Graham?
Please, the court. This is an unusual case in that it is a garnishment. Counsel for the appellant treats it like a default judgment, but it's not really a default judgment in that his client was not a party to the garnishment. His client is entitled to notice that the garnishment's been filed, but it was an agreed judgment entered by the court below. It was not a default judgment. We're required to serve the citation on the bank and then merely notify under 663A the judgment debtor. So in that sense, it's not truly a default judgment. Whether or not then a party who wasn't entitled to be served but only served a notice under 21A is then entitled to a motion for new trial, I don't think the law is really, really clear on. But I think what you can't lose sight of is what is before the court today is, did the court below abuse its discretion in denying the motion for new trial? And, of course, our position is that the court did not abuse its discretion. part of what, of course, they rely on in their brief and today is that, number one, there wasn't sufficient notice given, and number two, that they weren't allowed 3 days' notice. As I pointed out in my brief, neither of these points are contained in their motion for new trial. Counsel, in his reply brief, directs the court to pages 35 and 36 of the court's record, and if you examine those, all it talks about is he didn't believe there was sufficient notice under Rule 633A. He doesn't say why he thought it was defective. He never uses the word 3 days' notice. He never uses the word it was an effective service. And he doesn't mention why he thinks it's defective service. As a bit of a background, I'll tell you there was a phone conversation between myself and opposing counsel in which I informed him I'd faxed the notice to his client, and he told me that wasn't good service and I needed to read the rule. Well, luckily I had read the rule, and I'd read Rule 633A says all I have to do is serve his client under Rule 21A, which allows for fax service. And that was done. And proof of this service was provided to the counsel, and then it was incumbent upon him to act. But back to my reply to his points, these points were never raised in the court below. So how can the judge have abused his discretion in denying the motion for new trial if these points were never raised, that being service at all and 3 days' notice of the judgment? Thirdly, is the issue of whether or not he's entitled to a new trial if he had raised those issues. And one of the things he has to do is show that there's no negligence. Now, he denies this, but I pointed out to the court in my brief the Bank One Moody case, which is a Supreme Court case from 1992, in which the court talks about a motion for a new trial, and not every mistake of law is considered to be negligence. And what he is alleging happened here is a mistake of law. He miscalculated when he needed to make an appearance to try to stop the garnishment. And the First National Bank of Bryan case I cited was a garnishment case in which the bank officials thought that they didn't need to respond, so they didn't. And the court said, well, that was a mistake of law, but it's not enough to get you a motion for a new trial because it's more than just, it's not a mistake that constitutes negligence that entitles you to that. And as I pointed out in my brief, certainly if a bank official is held to that kind of standard, a lawyer would be held to a higher standard than that. I do want to point out, Your Honor, in my brief, I cited the Gertie's case to support my point that he needed to have brought up in his motion for new trial these points about the 3 days' notice and notice at all. And I cited it as Southwest Second, and it is, in fact, Southwest Third, which probably your briefing attorneys have already determined.
Excuse me. I just wanted to ask a question about
yes,
the First Bank of Bryan case again. Was that case applying the Craddock standard?
Yes, ma'am.
And they call it negligence.
And they discussed in that case that their failure to realize that they needed to respond was negligence and were not simply a mistake of law that would entitle them to a new trial. And part of also his grounds, Your Honor, he mentioned it in his argument, was the fact that the return from the Secretary of State mentions the name Lease Finance LLC rather than Lease Finance Group LLC. As I've stated in my brief, that's simply a misnomer, not in the citation, not in the petition, but in the return by the Secretary of State to me. This very court, on April 23rd of this year, issued an opinion in Union Square versus Clay, in which it found that such a misnomer does not void the service, and that if that defendant is otherwise clear that it's the defendant being served, that the service is good. Your Honor, I think in this case it's very clear that what happened here was the citation was served upon, a judgment was obtained in the court below, a garnishment was served upon the defendant's bank, The defendant was notified that garnishment in compliance with 663A, and they did nothing about it, and they did nothing timely. Their point, if what they're trying to achieve, is to attack the underlying judgment. And as counsel pointed out to you, there is a bill of review so attacking that underlying judgment. And as I cited the McEwen case in my brief, that direct attack is the sole remedy they have to attack that underlying default judgment that they wish to void in order to avoid collection efforts by my client. It is our position that the court below, when it decides that bill of review, will decide all these matters and what needs to be done with the case as a whole, and if in fact the docket sheet that's included in the court's record notes, there is a note by the judge that he's denying the motion for new trial to allow and would simply allow the parties to go forward with their bill of review in that same court. Thank you.
I have a question. So what impact does the pending bill of review have on our ability to dispose of this garnishment judgment issue?
I'm not sure it has any effect on this separate case at all. It just seems repetitive in that if the court below denies that.
But what if the court grants it?
Grants the bill of review?
Yeah, what if the court grants a bill of review and the default judgment is determined to be void?
Then they will have a claim to get their money back. Just the very same as if you do anything, because the money's been paid. And so if the court below voids that default judgment, then they've got to try to get their money back, just as they would here. And I think it's a matter for the court below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Just briefly, Your Honor. The negligence standard, as I previously said, was abandoned by the Texas Supreme Court in Ivey versus Carroll and in Ferguson versus Roe a long time ago. Further, the Texas courts have recognized in several cases that an error as to when to respond does not constitute intentional disregard or conscious indifference. Corpus Christi Court held that in Farrell versus Farrell. El Paso held it in Continental Airlines. And the Corpus Christi Court again in Hendricks versus Kirby. There is a difference between deciding not to answer and miscalculating the answer date. I would take issue as to some of the comments made which were not on the court's record during the course of this and merely state that the facts go beyond those. But regardless of that, the issues are three. One, was there service as required by the by the rules governing garnishment. The motion for true new trial was sufficient to raise the issue, and the court had no evidence that my client was served or when it was served. Service is not waivable, and as the court has stated in my brief, in a garnishment action, while you may waive a defect in the writ by appearing, you do not, you do not waive the failure of service by appearing. That's Walnut Equipment Leasing versus J.V. Dirt and Loan. The garnishment case cited by the, the case in regard to only being able to attack a judgment through a bill of review is not correct. These Texas courts have said regularly that if a judgment in garnishment, or if the underlying judgment in a garnishment is void, it may be attacked in the garnishment proceeding. That would be Stewart versus U.S. Custom Paint and Body, 870 Southwest 2nd, 18. This is a void judgment. The underlying judgment is a void judgment. the problem with waiting to handle that in the bill of review proceeding is my client is still subject to the judgment and the loss of its property in this proceeding and is entitled to deal with that in this proceeding. If it were appropriate to wait to until the bill of review proceeding had gone forward, the ruling in Stewart, which I just cited to you, would be superfluous. The answer would be you have to go to a bill of review, and the Supreme Court has said that is not the rule. I would also note while the trial court below said it was an agreed judgment, if you will look at the judgment, the bank did not agree to it. It merely agreed to the form. So it was not an agreed judgment. It is in the nature of default judgment, impinging upon my client's rights, and handled in a manner in which it did not have notices required by law. Even if it did, under the ruling of Craddock, my client is entitled to a new trial. We'd ask the court remand accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Thank you, Mr. Cram. Appreciate your arguments. Your case is submitted. And we will adjourn court. Thank you.